Welcome to Haunted Hospitality. Southern stories told by spooky gingers. I'm Robin.
And I'm Zoe. And I have a story for you guys today. But first, Robin, how is life?
Well, I'm a little freaked out.
Oh, no.
Because I watched The Conjuring for part two.
For part two.
For a Patreon episode with you.
Yes, you did.
And it was spooky.
Kind of. Okay, so I did. I mean, we're going to talk about it in our Patreon episode, but like,
yeah,
I do have a stream of consciousness that is all caps, series of curse words. So,
oh, like from being scared?
Yeah, that was like instead of screaming or being like, ah, instead I was watching it while also typing FG, OMG, like.
So we are going to get into this a little bit more, but I first watched it when I was in high school. Oh, Lord, I was so scared. I was so scared. But I think like this podcast has taught me to like just separate the scary things from my brain. Separate them. Because I was able to sleep last night.
I've had the same thing where it's like I was watching the movie, and even though I was like kind of like cursing it out, I was just like also just casually eating popcorn and being like, well, the movie's going to end eventually.
Yeah. Right. I was like, this is going to be over at some point. I'm not getting like sucked into like the horror of the movie, which I mean, like, it could be. I was also kind of purposefully not doing it because I was watching it alone and it was kind of getting dark out. And like, I prefer to be okay versus not okay. But yeah, I just it's an interesting phenomenon, like the ability to be a little bit separate when you're watching like a horror movie.
I wonder how much of that is like from desensitization. Because you and I are, like, I probably pronounced that wrong, but, like, from you and I, like, constantly in these spooky things, and how much of it is just because we're older?
I feel like that could be a big thing, too, because I feel like Conjuring was, like, maybe the first franchise of horror movies that I, like, got, like, not really into, but, like, was actively watching as a teenager, and so I was, like, learning to experience horror movies. Which by this point I'm like, okay, I've seen them. I can tell we're about to get a jump scare. I'm gonna look away now. These are the things that I do to keep myself okay.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that later. Zoe, how's life?
Well, as you already know, because apparently you were Facebook stalking me, I went to IKEA yesterday.
It came up on my timeline.
But no, I went to IKEA yesterday, and it was like right after the hurricane, so like. Luckily, we got there pretty much right as it opened. And so what we did was, because we were going specifically for the Alex drawers, and this is like a YouTuber sensation, apparently. So this is how Kari knew about it. But we went back in 2021, I think, right? No, maybe it was even earlier this year. But it was right at the tail end of the lumber shortage. And Kari wanted the Alex drawers in black. And we went, and we could only find the Alex drawers in white. And I was like, okay, so I have a white PC case. Kari, you have a black PC case. That's why you want it in black. Well, get the white one. You'll use it for now. And then when the black one comes in stock, we'll go back out and we'll buy that one, and I'll take the white one and you'll have the black one.
This is very logical of you.
Thank you. Because otherwise we would have driven up to IKEA to get like a fake plant and a couple of glasses. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. We never really followed up on getting the black one until I think it was about a month ago. I was like, hey, so my desk is getting really, really cluttered really quickly. I'd like to have a set of drawers, so let's go ahead and go to IKEA and get you the black ones. And we planned to go on Memorial Day weekend. And then Kari on Wednesday was like, hey, you remember that surgery that I was going to get? Yeah, I forgot. It's scheduled for tomorrow. And so we couldn't go that weekend. Because he was recovering from his surgery.
Okay, this is no shade on Kari. How do you forget you're having a surgery tomorrow?
So, like, it was originally scheduled for a little bit later into the month. but mm-hmm. then they had to reschedule it for him.
You meant Labor Day. So you Labor meant Day. Labor Day.
I did mean Labor Day. Sorry.
Like, how did May get into this?
No, Labor Day. Labor
okay,
Day.
Okay.
Yeah. So he had it like scheduled for later in the month and then they had to reschedule. And he said that they would call him back. And then like he forgot to tell me because I had to take the day off work too to like drive him and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's like he just totally forgot until he got a reminder email like the day before, because in his calendar, it was still set for the old date.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. But anyway, so we were supposed to go then, but we couldn't make it. And then we're just so busy right now. So we ended up going yesterday immediately after the hurricane. And so what we did was we went in, we found the specific drawers, we bought it. We put it into the car, and then we walked through IKEA, and then didn't buy anything.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It was weird.
It's very interesting, Zoe. I don't think I'd be able to do that. I'm always... I mean, it is designed to have you buy a lot.
Yeah.
IKEA's layout. Like, there's a reason you have to walk a mile once you enter the store to leave the store. And yeah. You're able to do that without buying anything.
Nope, we didn't buy a single thing except for the thing that we went there for.
Your willpower is amazing.
Well, thank you.
I can't compete. I would buy a lot.
Yeah.
I shouldn't, but I would.
But IKEA is just one of those places where you just are like, money isn't real.
No, yeah, it's like, oh, this is a good steal. This is a good steal because if I saw this in another store, it'd be more expensive.
Yes.
But you already own one.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is new. And because they have it set up in pretty ways.
And we were looking for something. I was looking for podcast chairs. Like, because we need actual podcast chairs. And I'd like to redo our podcast area. I mean, we have some months. But whenever you feel up to it, Robin, I'd like to go thrifting with you to see if we can find something.
I would love to go thrifting with you. Remember, I created a mood board.
You did
or a Pinterest board or something for
somewhere.
Us. it exists.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll do that for sure.
But anyway, do you have a something for us?
I do. I have a something spooky for us. So I decided, like, you know, what's funny? What not funny? What's fun? That's it. And then I was like, the theater. Theater superstition. So I found a listicle of 13 theater superstitions. One of them doesn't make sense to me, so I'm only going to tell you 12.
Okay.
It was on the Broadway Direct website, and it's by Mark A. Robinson. So I just kind of scrolled through here, and they're very interesting. Do you want to hear?
Yeah. No. I'm kidding. Of course I do.
Okay, well, I'll tell our audience. You can plug your ears. Don't listen when you're editing either.
So,
first up is a bad dress rehearsal means the show will be a hit.
Okay.
So apparently, if you screw up in dress rehearsal, I feel like that makes sense with wishful thinking.
Yeah.
It also shows you what could go wrong, so you know to fix it.
And also, just having that superstition is probably really good for, like, your mental space, because you're like, oh my god, I messed everything up. And if you're in that mental space, you're going to be like, oh, I'm going to mess everything up later. But if somebody's like, don't worry, that just means the show's going to be a hit, you're like, oh, okay, cool.
I'm not messed up. Next one we have, and this is kind of a rare one, mm-hmm. It says, I know how to speak, blue should not be worn on stage.
Really?
Apparently. Well, this isn't so much used, and also they think like the reason is because blue dyes were actually really expensive back in, I don't know, olden times. But it is listed here as a superstition nonetheless. Next is, never light a trio of candles.
Interesting.
Don't have three. Also, you know, beware of fire in general.
Yeah.
Next is, turn on the ghost light before leaving the theater. And I was like, what's a ghost light? So apparently a ghost light is light kind of, I think, in the center of the stage. And the idea is, it's actually quite practical advice, because if you don't have it on when you're leaving and after you turn off all the other lights, there's things that could get in the way. Stages have trap doors. Stages have different things that could get in your way. So keep the light on.
All right.
Next is, never bring a peacock feather on stage. Apparently, they think like the feather, because it has like kind of like a thing that looks like an eye, a design that looks like an eye, and they say like it's kind of like the evil eye.
Oh. Okay.
So don't bring a peacock feather on stage. It's very specific, but very bad. This next one, I could do so much. Mirrors on stage are bad luck.
I can see that just because, I mean, things move around a lot on stage, and also you don't want the audience to see themselves.
Don't want the audience to see themselves. And also, like, you have bright spotlights. One could, like, just hit the mirror at, like, just the wrong way for, like, a segment of your audience. So it's practical, but also I don't like having a mirror around me in my room or anything. And it is because I grew up very, like, scared of a ghost showing up in my mirror. And when I got older, I realized, oh, hey, I don't have to actually put a mirror in my bedroom. I sleep much better for it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always, like, to me, a mirror is just, like, the possibility of something creepy happening, and I just cannot take it.
Okay.
I can't stand it. Whistling backstage in a theater is considered a jinx.
Okay.
I didn't know this, but also, this would fit in well with me, because I cannot whistle.
Oh.
Zoe,
oh.
Can you whistle?
Did you hear that?
No.
Okay, that was Discord. But yes, I can whistle.
Okay, well, good for you.
Whew. Oh, no.
I can hoot like an owl, I guess.
I guess.
Never give a performer flowers before a show.
Makes sense. You don't want to assume they're going to do good.
Because they might not. I'd be like, eh. I take my flowers back. Okay, this is probably my favorite. Give the director a graveyard bouquet. And this is for when, like, an actual play ends production. Like, you're no longer performing this play. The run ends. And the idea is go to a graveyard, get flowers from the graveyard, and then give it to the director.
Oh, I thought you were going to be like, oh, get a funeral flower arrangement, like, when you would typically order for a grave. Yeah.
No, go to a grave, steal flowers from the dead, and give them to the director.
And they're saying, do this, not don't.
They're saying, do it.
Okay.
It feels very theater.
Yeah, very dramatic.
Very dramatic. Like, oh, I'm sorry, your production.
Dead.
Here's some dead flowers. Dead people flowers. The flowers are alive. Well, actually, no, they're dying. Okay, unless they're like in a pot. Sorry. The next is beware of a visit from the ghost of Thespis.
Thespis? I'm guessing that's where thespian comes from.
It is. So I learned in the little blurb here that, you know, performances in Greece started with a chorus. So, like, the chorus is telling you the story. And so it's a group telling you the story. Thespis was apparently the first one to not just be a member of the chorus and to actually take on the role of a character in some sense. So he is the first actor.
Okay.
And so this says that, like, when theaters don't have a specific ghost to in their lore to blame shenanigans on, you say it's Thespis, his ghost.
Gotcha.
Doing things. The next one is say break a leg instead of good luck. And guys, don't do that.
Oh.
That's me. That's me saying don't do that.
Oh, don't break
a
leg.
Saying you should. I'm saying don't say it. If anybody ever says it to me, I'm going to be so mad. Just don't do it.
Okay.
Y'all, don't do it. Just say, I don't know, say bad luck. I don't know. Don't say break a leg. My gosh. The next one and the final one is probably the most well-known one.
Uh-huh.
Don't say Macbeth.
Oh, yeah.
In a theater.
I would say that the break a leg thing is probably more well-known than the Macbeth thing.
You're probably right, but I don't think of that as, like, just theater. I kind of thought of that as anything, but okay. Maybe it's like more specifically theater. Yeah, you're right, it's more specifically theater. But with the Macbeth thing, like, people would put on, you know, the play Macbeth, but you would then say the Scottish play,
yeah,
instead. And but you are allowed to say Macbeth in a theater when you are referring to the character of Macbeth,
right?
But not the play.
So I have a question.
Yeah,
what was the one you left out because it doesn't make sense?
Oh, okay.
I need to know. I'm sorry.
It seemed very specific to, like, Broadway in New York. And it said, beware of the ghost of David Belasco. And apparently it's talking specifically of Belasco Theater, which I guess he owned.
Okay.
And he was known as the Bishop of Broadway, yada, yada. But I was just like, I don't know how to explain, because I was thinking like general, right, not like specifically at this one theater in Broadway, which we are all familiar with in this Southern podcast.
Yeah, super, super familiar.
I am, yes. So Zoe, do you have a story for us today?
I do. And depending on how things go down, this may be a two-parter. So I guess you'll be able to tell if it says A or not in the title, because I refuse to do an odd episode. Unless, she Robin, does. You want to do a two-parter immediately after me. But I think you've already have everything planned.
I do.
Okay. All right. So if you remember during our Arkansas College Tour Palooza episode, the one in Arkansas, I brought I forget what the main college was, but the rival college was the Ouachita College.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought up that there was a murder there, and it's known as the Ouachita murder, or the Ouachita dorm mom mother murder.
Okay.
And so I briefly brought it up, and I was actually really wrong in my summation. That's what you get for only skimming a 20-page document instead of reading a 20-page document. So I'm here to correct my mistakes and give you a full breakdown of this murder.
Okay.
So the murder in question is that of Orrin Hendrickson in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, on March 10th, 1983. Orrin was 39 at the time of his death. He was married to Patricia Hendrickson, and they both owned a company named H&R Corporation, along with a friend and business partner, Paul Robertson. Orrin had a $600,000 life insurance policy, with the sole beneficiary being his wife. He also owned somewhere around $500,000 to $600,000 worth of land in Missouri. So in today's money, if you were to liquidate that real estate and get $1,200,000 and then converted it into 2022 money, that's $3,568,325 that would all go to his wife upon his death.
Okay.
So Patricia, who went by Pat, was also 39, and together they had a son named Bradley. Orrin and Pat met in college, and she dropped out of school after they got married. And as the old Southern ladies would say, she got her MRS degree.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs.
Yeah, the Mrs. degree.
Okay.
Because back then, when you go to college, it wasn't to get an education as a woman. It was to get your MRS degree.
For some.
For some. Yes, that was the stereotype.
Yes. Okay.
So, Pat had a friend named Norma. Norma was 48 years old, so a little bit older, about 9 years older. And she was the dorm mother of the Ouachita dorm called Ernest Bailey. And she was the athletic department secretary. She was also going to school full-time to get an accounting degree. She lived in her dorm apartment on campus, but she did also have a house in Arkadelphia. She was divorced with 3 sons, all of whom were stationed in Germany.
Mm.
Because she was mostly alone, Norma spent so much time with the Hendricksons that their son Bradley would often call her Aunt Norma. She would also frequently drive Pat to Hot Springs, Arkansas on Thursday afternoons because Pat had to get weekly allergy shots, and after she got the shot, it would make her feel sick, so she wouldn't be able to drive home on her own. And so Norma would pick her up, drive her to Hot Springs, she'd get the shot, and Norma would drive her back. I did go on Google Maps, and it takes about 50 minutes to get between the cities. So it would be 50 minutes there, 50 minutes back. But again, you have to add the time to get to the specific doctor and from the specific house. And I don't know if the roads were different in the 1980s.
Yeah. So either way, I mean, it's a big trip to make every week.
Yeah. It's about 2 hours of the car together alone for once a week. Because of how much time Norma and Pat spent together, many people around them thought that they were slightly more than just friends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, during this time era, like, people thought that, mm-hmm. like, as it's happening versus, like, in hindsight?
Yeah, as it's happening, people, like, were looking into it. Like, it became under scrutiny by the college because they were like, you can't keep coming here with your girlfriend because she was living on the campus. And,
okay.
And, like, there were definitely rumors going around. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, Norma would babysit Bradley, the Hendrickson son, on campus to the point that all the other employees knew him, and Norma would frequently show up to, I'm sorry, Pat would normally show up to Norma's offices to pick Bradley up, and they would often spend time within closed office to talk to each other. Whenever Oren was out of town, they would go to Hot Springs, not just to get the allergy medicine, but as a vacation. And they would stay at the Holiday Inn together alone.
You said that so salaciously.
Yes.
Alone.
Alone. Okay. This is a sentence that I thought I would ever say in my entire life. There is this place that existed.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. So Norma and Pat would go to this bar called BJ's Star-Studded Honky Tonk, and it's a dance bar, so you'd go there and you'd do a little square dance with a bunch of people. And let me just tell you the name again. It's called BJ's Star-Studded Honky Tonk.
No, I've been absorbing it. I've been.
And they have a Facebook page. And I went to the Facebook page because the store is not open anymore. And it's a bunch of old people being like, they don't have places like BJ Star Studded Honky Tonk anymore.
No, they don't.
And they post photos of themselves when they went there. And, like, the comments are filled with, like, Greg, how you been?
I am glad that it fostered such community mm-hmm. that lives on. The spirit of BJ's truly lives on.
Yep. You said it, Robin.
I did.
But yes, so this is where Norma and Pat decided to spend their time. They supposedly would go to, quote, listen to the music, but they would actually go under fake names. So Norma would go by her middle name, Jean, and Pat would go by the name Joyce. So they'd be Joyce and Jean.
Okay.
And it just reminds me of that thing that, like, is stereotypical Hollywood, where couples will, like, pretend like they don't know each other and go under aliases and, like, pretend to have an affair with each other. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it kind of reminds me of that. So okay. People around Norma would say that she didn't go on dates. She never was really in a relationship ever since she divorced her husband. And she wouldn't really speak about her romantic life. And as for Pat, well, she was married, so of course she wouldn't talk about things like that. However, Pat, while we don't have specifics about her life and where she was headspace, the fact that Oren does die and she is in an alleged homosexual relationship with Norma, perhaps she wasn't the happiest. Pat knew that, well, okay, let's just say this. Pat was thinking about divorce.
Okay.
However, she knew that if she divorced Oren, and there's already all these allegations that she's in a relationship with Norma, there's no judge that would be fair to her, in her mind, at least. She's thinking that if she tries to go divorce Oren, all he would have to say is, she's gay, and suddenly she doesn't get any alimony, she doesn't get the split profits. And her son goes to Oren, and she's just basically on the streets alone. This is what she is picturing for herself. So she somehow traveled down the thought process of, well, if only Orin would die, then I would get what I want and I would get to keep everything too.
Okay.
So in late November 1982, it does seem that Pat has settled on the idea of murder. She actually spoke to a coworker named John Clark about divorce and then like verbalized to him, oh, well, that won't do. That's where we get, because Pat never really testifies for her own case. She doesn't admit to anything. But John Clark came up and was like, well, first she said divorce, but then said that she wouldn't get anything. And then she asked me about murder and was like, and he just kind of like was shocked and changed the subject whenever she did.
Okay.
And so Pat, when John Clark wasn't able to give her any answers, Pat went to Norma and said, I wonder if it's possible to hire somebody to have my husband killed.
I mean, yes, it is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And Norma was like, oh, no, don't worry about it. Everybody has bad times in their relationships. Don't kill or divorce him over it.
Emphasis on the don't kill him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, unfortunately, like, Pat kept bringing it up. And so Norma was like, well, I do know about these two boys. So, let me get into these two boys, okay? So, Howard Vaggy, I think it's pronounced, is 21 years old and he's from New Jersey. He is majoring in pre-engineering with a minor in political science. He's short, but also very strong because he was a competitive wrestler. Now, Howard had a friend named Mark. Mark was also 21 years old, but he was studying chemistry and biology. And Norma had a class with Howard, and Howard was friends with Mark. And so the three of them started hanging out together a little bit, which is weird to me because they're 21 and she's 48. But
valid.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not so weird because it is a college campus.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark was well known for bragging about his grandfather having mafia connections. During the trial, he denied it. But anyone who knew him was like, oh, Mark, you mean the guy who constantly talks about his grandpa who was in the mafia? That Mark? So, like, that's how he was known. So there was also a well-known murder case in Little Rock, Arkansas, and it had involved paid murder. And Mark was also very vocal about his interest in this case. And he would, I think he was like kind of like puffing up his chest a little bit, and he was claiming he knew more details than he probably actually did about it. And he was very interested in this case, talked about it a lot, and it's known as the MacArthur Ornsey case of 1981. And we're not done with the BJ star-studded honky-tonk, by the way, because it turns out that the owner of the BJ star-studded honky-tonk is none other than the Mr. MacArthur that is in the MacArthur Ornsey case, where he hired somebody to kill someone. I forget who, but
okay.
So okay. There are people theorizing that Norma and Pat only started going to this bar because they knew he was related to a case that involved a hitman. And I couldn't tell chronologically when they started going to the bar. So I don't know if that was a coincidence, and so then they started asking questions, or if that's the sole reason they started going to BJ's star-studded honky-tonk.
Okay.
Norma and Pat were spending time together one day, and Norma was like, hey, I want to kill my husband or hire someone to. And finally, I'm sorry, Pat was saying that. And then finally, Norma was like, Okay, so I know this kid. This kid says he has mafia connections and he knows a lot about hiring somebody to kill someone. And so Pat was like, I gotta know this kid. Please introduce me to him. In late January or early February, Mark was at Norma's house and they were watching TV and playing cards together when Norma asked him if he knew a hitman. And Mark was shocked by the question and did not give her an answer. And I guess they continued playing cards.
How do you continue playing cards after that?
I don't know.
Be like, go fish.
However, later that evening, Mark had left Norma's place and was studying with Howard. And he's like, hey, so guess what Norma asked me? And then so Mark and Howard often have conflicting testimony. But according to Mark's testimony, Howard was like, oh, getting hired to kill someone sounds like a good way to get money. And according to Howard, he didn't think about it, but instead Mark was like, oh, no, no. According to Howard, he thought Mark was joking and decided to go along with the joke.
Okay.
So a week later. This is all convoluted like this.
I'm like tracing the idea from the sort. Okay, so Pam to Norma to Mark to Howard.
Yeah. And Howard was like,
may or may not think it's a joke.
Yes.
Okay.
So he told.
Has anybody ever heard of a red flag?
Yes. I don't know. I guess not. Not in this situation.
Okay. Okay.
So Mark was like, oh, cool. Howard's into it. So a week later, he went to Nora and was like, hey, you remember that Norma. Really awkward. Did I say Norma?
You said Nora.
Oh, I'm sorry. So he went to Norma and he was like, hey, you remember that awkward conversation that we had over cards the other day? So it turns out I do know someone who's interested in getting paid to kill someone.
I would stop knowing that person immediately.
Well, Norma was like, this is a quote from a paper I was reading. Norma was, quote, not impressed because she thought Howard too immature, but she went along with it anyway.
What is up with all these people going along with it anyway?
I don't know. And like, that's the pivotal reason that any of this end up happening is people are like, I think this is weird, but I'm gonna do it anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a few days later, Norma. Okay, this is so weird. Norma wrote the name Orrin Hendrickson on a piece of paper. She showed it to Mark and then she tore it up. And then Mark went to Howard and was like, yo, the name is Orrin Hendrickson.
Okay.
Step one out of the way. Or I guess that's step two. Step one was finding someone. Step two is the name. So a few days later, Mark and Norma met once more and she gave him a detailed map of the neighborhood that Pat and Orrin lived in. And the map was to scale to the 10th of the mile and it included the color of the house and the type of driveway. So then Mark and Howard were in that neighborhood a few days later eating at a burger place when Mark was like, hey, you know what's really near here? The house of the guy you agreed to murder. So he shows Howard the map and they decide to drive by it that night just to get like a lay of the land. And so they find the house and they're like, OK, so that's the house we're going to commit a crime in. Got it. So he was like, hey, how should I get into the house to kill this guy? So Norma was like, that's a really good question. And went and met up with Pat. And there's days in between these meetings. OK. So she went to Pat and she's like, hey, how do you want your husband to die? And Pat was like, oh, Howard should go into the side house or the side door using a key I will give him. That way Howard can be in the house by the time Orrin gets home. And that's how you'll get in. And so even though that didn't really answer the question of how should I kill him, Norma was like, cool, I'll go tell them this. So she told Mark and Mark told Howard and Howard was like, hey, can I get a picture of Orrin so that I won't kill the wrong person, essentially. So Norma, Mark, and Howard visit Pat at Pat's house. And Pat takes Howard to the back bedroom and is like, you have to kill my husband. Here's why I'm killing him. Also, here's a photo of him. Keep it. And so he kept the picture for a few days and then he cut it up and flushed it down the toilet. So the next meeting was to discuss the price of the hit. So how much they're going to get paid for it. So Mark and Howard were talking about it. And according to Mark's testimony, Howard came up with the price of $16,000. However, Howard said, Mark said, hey, the Little Rock hit that I mentioned before with the honky tonk, that was done for $20,000. So we're in a smaller town. You should do it for $16,000. And so $16,000 became the total that they were going to kill this man for.
Zoe, I have no idea how to process any of what you just told me.
It's just so everywhere.
It is everywhere. It is.
And it's like they're trying to be spies about it. They all think that they're being like cooler than they are, but they aren't. They're fumbling around.
I think to me, it's like that all the information travels by like through four different people right. And then back before I.
So Norma talks. Okay. No, Pat talks to Norma, who talks to Mark, who talks to Howard. And then Howard goes to Mark, who talks to Norma, who talks to Pat. But then, like, the whole reason they're doing that is so that Pat and Howard don't have to communicate. So it's like people can't be like, oh, I saw her talking to that guy and he's the guy that looks like the guy who killed him.
But then the guy straight up came to her house. Yeah. And she gave him a photo of her husband and was like, here are the precise reasons I want you to kill him.
Exactly.
All right. All right.
So Pat agreed to the price, which went through the channel, and also told Mark that she would help him with tuition and school duties if he ended up struggling with that. And yes, she told that to Mark, not Howard, even though Howard's the one who's going to be killing her husband.
Okay.
So her down payment was $120 for supplies. So this is another thing where Mark and Howard say different things. Mark's story is that he dropped off Howard at a pawn shop, and then Howard walked around town to various pawn shops looking for guns, but they were all too expensive, so he returns to the original one and buys a 12-gauge single-shot shotgun for $50. Howard says that information is true. However, Mark was with him the whole time. And in fact, it was Mark who actually technically bought the gun because Howard didn't have an Arkansas license and Mark did.
Okay.
And in all of these things where it's like they differ, it tends to be Mark saying like, oh, I didn't do anything. It was all Howard. And Howard being like, well, no, he did things too. Mm-hmm. And I'm more inclined to believe Howard because of how the case the trial goes down, but I'll get that in a minute. I just want to let you know I believe Howard's side of the story more than I believe Mark's.
Okay.
So they went to another stop and they bought ammo, and then they went to a mutual friend's house to test out the gun. And while they were testing out the gun, it like kind of fell apart a little, so they used duct tape to fix it.
That's not good. That is bad safety. That is very bad.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, all of this is like really bad.
Yeah.
Like in every way.
Uh-huh.
But like that's like really bad gun safety.
Yeah. No, okay. I'm with you.
Okay. I had to say that. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I think you're blowing my mind here. Continue, I guess.
Yeah. So Howard, Mark did the next step. They both say the other did it. But then they went and bought something called a double-aught buck shell. I don't know what that means, but I figure it means something specific.
That was the most fake thing I've ever heard. I don't know what it means, but I figure it's something. Okay, okay. Sorry.
So together they drove down to the Little League's field near the river, and they shot the gun out into, like, the river. And apparently there was, like trash on the river shore. Like, people had dumped things there. And so Howard shot a stove or old washing machine and left a 6-inch hole in the metal.
Who dumps a washing machine by the river?
I don't know. Or a stove.
Or a, neither of those. And I mean, like, don't litter in general, but also, like, an appliance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's beside the point, majorly, but goodness.
So, the last thing to do was to determine the date and time of the murder. So, Pat told everyone that it had to be before spring break, because Pat had a plan to go to Cancun with Oren, and she really didn't want to go. And then Norma said that it has to be a Thursday so that Norma and Pat could be on their way to Hot Springs for the allergy shot so that they would have an alibi. And so Pat was like, oh, Oren's usually home early on Thursday, so that works. So they arranged for the murder to look like a robbery, to the point that Pat gave Howard a map of inside the house and, like, circled objects of interest for him to rob, including a stack of cash that she was going to hide in one of the bedrooms for him to take. That way she could report it all missing, get the insurance money, but still get her stuff back later. And so,
does she normally keep large stacks of cash around the house?
Yes, I think so, because they're very well off.
Like, do very well off people keep large stacks of cash around the house?
In this time when you didn't really have credit cards, maybe.
Okay. Okay.
It was in an envelope, if that makes you feel better.
No, actually, that makes less sense.
I'm sorry. So they decided that the attack was going to be March 3rd, 1983. Mark picked up Howard and they drove one exit past the house, like the neighborhood. And then Howard got out of the car and walked through the woods to go to the house. And he got in through the side door, and Oren was supposed to be home by 4 p.m., but soon 5 p.m. came and went. So Howard packed up his things, took the $500 that Pat told him to steal, and then he left the house and hitchhiked his way back to the Washita campus. Norma called Howard later that night and said that Pat wanted to see him, and Howard said no. So the next day, he did go over, and Pat chewed him out, basically. It was like, why is my husband still alive? And so they agreed to try again the next Thursday, March 10th. In between the two Thursdays, Howard went out and bought a 125cc Kawasaki dirt bike, which stayed at Norma's house. Mark also gave the $500 back to Pat. I'm sorry, Howard gave the $500 back to Mark to give to Pat for the second attempt. Now, Robin, would you prefer a slightly longer episode so that we don't have to summarize that next episode? Or do you want to stop here and go into two parts? I think two parts. I mean, longer episode might work.
Wait, okay, which do you think would work? Longer episode or two parts?
The longer episode.
Let's just do a longer episode.
Because otherwise I have to summarize all of that next time.
It's a lot, so... yeah, let's just go ahead.
Okay. So on the morning of March 10th, Mark picked Howard up and drove him to Norma's house, and they picked up the bike from Norma's house. The gun was broken down into parts to fit onto the back of the bike, and then Howard drove up to the house, hid his bike in the wood. Okay, Mark drove Howard up to the house. Howard hid his bike in the woods, and then he went into the back bedroom so that he could wait for Oren to drive up while Mark drove away. So the bike is in the woods for his getaway, but he is now in the house in the early morning waiting for Oren.
Okay.
So after waiting there for a bit, he fell asleep. And then at 11 a.m., he heard Oren coming into the house, and the gun was still in pieces.
Okay.
So I think the plan had been a little bit more eloquent than this, but basically where he was in the room, he could see directly into the kitchen and directly to the door that was the room between the garage and entering the house. Like they had this little washroom or like utility room.
I'll be honest with you, I did not understand that layout.
Okay, so it's the garage, and then there's a little utility room that has a door to the garage and a door to the kitchen. And if you walk through that utility room into the kitchen, you can see directly into the bedroom that Howard is in. So basically, immediately, if Oren came in the door and opened it, he would immediately be able to see Howard. And so Howard panicked, put the gun together, and the moment he saw a briefcase come through that door, he pulled the trigger. And unfortunately, he was lucky and he did get Oren straight in the chest. And so Oren fell face first down onto the kitchen floor. And so Howard went around the house, stole the things that they previously agreed that he could steal. And then he went to step over Oren's body into the garage to leave. And he thought he heard Oren breathing. So he did a point blank shot to his jugular and ensured that he was not alive.
That is, I mean, all of this is a lot, but that is just such a cold act.
Yeah, like the panicking and shooting the gun, I can kind of understand. Like, if you're oh,
Well, I
not.
mean, everything led up to it.
Yeah. Because, like, the panicking, because this all seems like fumbling. They don't really understand what's going on. They're not. Well, they understand what's happening. It's just like they all seem to be paddling in water and it's slowly rising over their head. But this one move to me kind of seals the deal of he wasn't just going with the flow. He was like, I'm getting my money.
Yeah, I mean, it all culminates in this one act, and that act is ending a life. And all of these people had a major part to play because it sounds like it wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have happened in the way that it did without each of those players.
Right, if even one person was like, maybe I should go to the police about this,
Yeah.
he would still be alive. Well, maybe not to this day, but he would have lived the rest of his life.
Yeah, for sure.
So he then walked out to go get his bike, but then he realized that he forgot to empty Oren's wallet to make it look like a robbery. So he went back in, took $150 in cash out of Oren's wallet. He kicked out the bathroom window to make it look like that's how somebody got in. And then he drove away. He drove his
He
bike,
rode, right?
rode his, drove his bike. It's a motorbike. It's a dirt
Oh, okay.
bike. So he drove into the woods and on his bike. He stashed the gun and then he drove the bike out to a predetermined spot, left it there, and then hitchhiked back to campus. He went to Mark's organic chemistry class where Mark was taking a test, and Mark excused himself and went outside to speak to Howard when he saw him out the window. And according to Mark, Howard was eating popcorn or sunflower seeds and casually said, I did it. Mark then asked one or two, and Howard replied two, and they were talking about the number of shots that he fired. And then Mark went back to take his test. And Norma and Pat were on their way home from the hot springs. So they went to Bradley's school to pick him up for soccer practice. And I'm guessing it wasn't done yet. And they were gonna like watch the end of it. But they got to his soccer practice and it was cold outside and they didn't have their jackets. So they told Bradley, like, hey, we'll be right back. We're just going to go get jackets from your house, basically Pat's house. And so Pat and Norma drove back to the house, and Oren's car was at the house. And this part confuses me because all of this that I've told you about, where they're planning this murder, going back and forth, they knew it was planned for today. they arrive at the house, see Orin's car, and Norma says, oh, I guess he didn't go to his Kiwanis club, because he always goes to Kiwanis club on Thursday. And Pat replied, Norma, he may even be in there dead. To which Norma said, Pat, that's not even funny. And claims that she thought Pat was joking. And I'm like, I'm sorry. What has been the last 50 minutes of this podcast? You guys planning his murder. What do you mean you thought she was joking?
Had her nerves made her enter like a different headspace for the day? I don't understand.
Was she thinking like this whole thing had been a joke, that nobody was going to move forward with it? Like, I don't understand. I really don't understand what was happening there. So Pat, it was dark outside, so Pat got out of the truck, but Norma stayed in the car until Pat got into the garage and was able to turn the lights on, because she was using, like, the headlights to light her way. So Pat was ahead of Norma. Once she saw that Pat went inside the house, Norma turned off the car and followed her. And by the time Norma got into the house, she saw Pat standing over Orin and crying. So okay. Norma called the police and she told them what they just found. She told him that the blood was dry, so it probably happened earlier in the day. And then she got off the phone. So I think it's very important for me to stress this. The phone, she was no longer on the phone with the police when Pat, quote, went into hysterics and then just sunk to the floor next to Orin's body and was crying and just a mess, essentially. And so Norma was like, okay, Pat's not going to be able to do anything right now. So she calls a family friend named Gary to take Bradley home to stay the night. And the police arrive and investigate the crime scene. And Pat apparently was so hysterical that they had to call a doctor to give her a sedative. So Pat stayed with Norma for 2 weeks after this with Bradley until she was able to find an apartment, because she told everyone that she just couldn't stand to be in the house anymore. 3 days after the murder, Pat and Norma were questioned, but not as suspects, but just as a, like, what did you see? Did you see anyone in the house?
Witnesses, conceivably.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they all went to the funeral a few days later. There was, after that, it was spring break, so Howard went home to El Dorado with Mark, and that's where they sawed up the gun and scattered the parts around a lake. And then Mark gave Howard $1,000 that he had gotten from Pat. They returned after spring break to campus.
Wait, Mark gave Howard $1,000?
Yes, because Howard was the one who actually killed him.
But who got the $16,000?
So $16,000 was supposed to go to Howard. But okay. Norma, I'm sorry, Pat was going to pay it in small installments instead of, like, withdrawing $16,000 from her bank account immediately after killing her husband, or having immediately after her husband died.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So they returned after spring break and they all met up at Norma's house. And so all four of them, but there was another friend there named Elaine. And so they couldn't talk about the murder. And then 3 weeks after the murder, Mark replaced Orin on a trip to go see a Mickey Gilly concert with Pat and Norma. So it was Pat, Norma, and Mark, and it was originally supposed to be Orin. Mark said that Pat was in a very good mood because of everything from the murder had gone smoothly and there weren't any leads. Mark tried to give Pat her house key back, but this concerned her because the police had asked her, like, they had noticed that the broken bathroom window was fake. Like, nobody actually, like, it was broken from inside the house. So they had asked her if there was a spare key, and she had told them no. And so she was now worried, like, oh, if they find this spare key, they're going to know I lied about that and everything will unravel. But then yeah. Norma was like, well, just put it inside the house. If the key was inside the house, it wouldn't matter. And I'm like, but she still said there was no spare key. I don't know. And I don't know what ended up happening with the key.
Mm-hmm.
On April 14th, 1983, Pat was asked to do a polygraph test, and she agreed to take the test. She was asked the following questions, and she replied no to all of them. Do you know for sure who killed Orrin on March 10th? Have you ever made plans with anyone to kill your husband? Did you shoot your husband to death on March 10th? Did you already know Orrin was dead when you arrived at the house? So like I said, she said no to all those. And she actually passed the polygraph test with perfect colors. And she fooled the detective who was in the room. And he wrote into the report that he was sure that she did not kill her husband and she had zero knowledge of who did.
Okay. I'm wondering just like what was going on in her head.
Yeah.
After all this. Because I mean, like, it seems like she, right before the body, decided or got, or I don't know what was going on in her head, but like, it just seems like she like started being in like real deep denial potentially, or I don't know, but like, you know, when she like had that response to seeing his body, it like seemed to me like, okay, well, the weight of what she has done has fallen on her, but it's just so,
yeah,
it's just so,
and like,
so
I guess the thought of I want my husband dead and seeing your husband's dead body is so different. Yeah,
it would be different. Yeah,
but yeah. So I guess she passed the polygraph test. I don't know if she's like in this dissociative state, I don't know. But we know polygraph tests aren't exactly perfect. So that summer, Mark stayed in town and Howard went to New Jersey. Norma went to Germany to visit her sons. But she told Mark before she left that she felt like Pat was distancing herself from her. And so I'm like, that's really interesting that she thought Pat was like backing away from their relationship. Because I've heard of relationships before where it's like they'll be in a relationship and partner A will convince partner B to help her kill their significant other. And then they immediately break it off after that.
Like, this is a thing?
Like, I've heard a couple other true crime stories that falls into that same pattern. Yeah.
Huh.
During that summer, Mark was playing on a ball team sponsored by Pat's company. When Pat sent him $1,900 to give to Howard when he came back. And then a few weeks after that, she called Mark to her house. And when he got there, she was upset because she had been questioned by the police. She says that she didn't tell them anything, but she was concerned that they're still questioning people. Mark was then also questioned by them on July 5th and September 16th.
I mean, of course they would still be questioning people. They didn't have any answers.
I guess she was kind of hoping that they would be like, oh, we don't have the answers. Let's sweep it under the rug and go on to the next one.
Okay, that's some quick sweeping over there, but okay.
Yeah. So Pat, this was really interesting. So Pat consulted with a psychiatrist where she ended up taking a series of IQ tests between August and early November. And she consistently got a rating of about 81, which is below average. The average American is between 90 and 110. And the quote from the psychiatrist in the trial was, in the people she would interact with, they would have much more ability than she would, and she would typically be expected to defer and go along with their suggestions. She tends to be very feminine, mousy, passive, dependent kind of person who would be expected to be very easily led. And I personally, this is my headcanon. I'm going beyond the facts, okay?
All right.
This is me thinking, it sounds like Pat is so manipulative that she was able to manipulate a psychiatrist into thinking that about her so that he could testify in court to make it seem like she just went along with the other's ideas instead of her own.
I see how you think that. I mean, I don't know I don't know what happened, but like that would be an interesting technique.
Yeah.
To use. Also, I know we're talking about a murder, but I just want to like put there that just the descriptive words were like pretty sexist.
Oh yeah, yeah, 100%.
Just so we're acknowledging that. It doesn't it's kind of separate from this case, but just in general.
Yeah, no, I agree. But like the fact that she even had the thought process of let me go to a psychiatrist to prove how stupid I am. Like, come on. Like, why else would you take IQ tests during this span of your life?
Yeah, an IQ test. Like, I'm so confused about how people would think, like, it in general would be relevant. Yeah. I guess, except for this exact reason.
And this was before there was any suspicion cast upon her.
I mean, she was questioned by the police like that.
Yeah, but at this point, they had no actual reason to suspect her other than she is a wife who stands to get a lot of money if her husband dies.
Okay.
So Howard did not come back to school during the fall, claiming he didn't know if he could ever come back as a student. He visited Mark in October, and he told him that he actually wasn't interested in collecting the rest of the $16,000, but he did request $40 to, quote, get him back on his feet. That would be over a little over $100 today, so I'm like, how would that really help you? But okay. Mark told him about the $1,900 that Pat had given to him, but Howard told him to keep it. So Howard then went back to New Jersey, and in November, Pat gave $4,000 more to Mark to give to Howard, not knowing that Howard said, no, I don't want the money anymore. So Mark's profiting off of this now.
Okay.
So on November 20th, 1983, Howard stays at his uncle's house in New Jersey and told him that there was something bothering him, and then he spilled everything. So his uncle called the New Jersey police that night, and they relayed the information to the Arkadelphia police, and that night the police arrived at Norma's house and Pat's house to arrest them both.
Can I just say good on the uncle?
I know. For, like,
swiftly doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So Howard was flown over to Arkadelphia. The county prosecutor went to Mark's house and told Mark that if he testified against Pat and Norma, he'd get immunity. So Mark agreed and was also brought into the jail. So between Howard and Mark, there was considerable evidence, not much that Pat or Norma could do to try to look innocent. Howard confessed to everything so that he would get the first degree murder sentence instead of capital felony murder, which carries a death sentence. He pled guilty and he instead got a life sentence. Mark provided his evidence in doses so that he would always have a gambling chip in case they wanted to pull the immunity offer. He was finally granted it and he was able to provide full testimony against both Norma and Pat. Norma was convicted of first degree murder and she was sentenced to life in prison.
Wait, really? First degree?
Mm-hmm. 'Cause, I mean, premeditated. Even though she wasn't the one who pulled the trigger, it couldn't have happened without her.
I thought first degree was, well, premeditated because that's what murder is. But I thought first degree was like, you did it in the moment. Like, it was, as in, like, you pulled the trigger.
Yeah, that was just what she was sentenced with. I don't know if it was correct, but it was what she got.
I mean, it's probably more correct than what I know. I'm nobody. Okay, cool.
I don't know. I feel like there should have probably been a charge of, like, not conspiracy to commit murder, because the murder did happen, but, like, you were a part of the planning, you know?
Well, I thought that's kind of what second degree was for.
I thought second degree...
Am I getting that all wrong?
I think second degree is, like, you kill them in the heat of the moment, but then you, like, purposely hide the body. Like, you purposely don't go to the police with the information that you killed someone.
Clearly we have some Googling to do after this. Feel free to continue.
But so she got sentenced to life for first degree murder. This is Norma. She appealed the decision and she actually won in the Arkansas Supreme Court because there was an illegally obtained record of her admitting something. I'm not sure what, but it was admitted into court. And you know, anything that is illegally obtained is not permissible in court, but it had been allowed in court. And they also brought her to the prosecutor's office for questioning, and that's also highly illegal, So all the information learned there, they could also not use in court. So she actually ended up being retried. And I don't know if this is the case in the original trial, but in the retrial, Pat was brought up as a witness against Norma, and she actually refused to testify. They would ask her, what's your name? And she would provide her name. What's your relation to the deceased? She provided that information. What's your relationship to Norma? And she would say, I plead the fifth.
Oh, okay.
So she refused to testify against Norma, which I'm like, I don't know if that's because if she did, that would kind of like put herself in a place where she's admitting her own guilt, or if she was trying to protect Norma in some way.
I don't know. So did she plead the fifth to the whole thing?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
So the Norma's convictions were actually reversed, and she left the country because she was afraid they were going to bring it back. She fled to Germany to live with her sons.
So wait, she was retried and I guess found innocent?
Yes, I believe that was the way it was. They said that it was reversed. I don't know if like they just found, oh, first degree murder's wrong. And then she was let out on bail. And so she, or not on bail, but she was at least not in prison anymore. And so she ran away to Germany. Or if she was found innocent and then she ran away to Germany.
Okay.
Patricia Hendrickson was found guilty of capital murder, and she was sentenced to death by the electric chair on December 13th, 1985, 2 years and 1 month after she was arrested. The case, however, was also reversed because she was denied access to her attorney. Her attorney was the prosecutor who brought in Mark. His name was Dub Arnold. And I'm like, well, why didn't you? Yeah. So the guy who was the prosecutor was the guy that she wanted to choose to be her attorney. But when he learned about the case before Norma was investigated or interrogated, he's like, hey, I can't be her attorney. He told the police, I'm not going to represent her. I can't. I am already related, like in this case, as the prosecutor. And so they went to interrogate her, and she's like, I don't want to speak to you. I want to speak to Dub, and which is the guy's name, Dub Arnold. And they said, well, we can't bring him to you right now, and continued interrogating her. However, what they were supposed to do was say, he is not able to represent you. We can appoint you a new attorney and stop interrogating until she got the attorney.
Yeah. They screwed that one up. You know, you have these rights for a reason.
And thus, everything in that interrogation that came to light, they were unable to use in court. It's like they were rushing the case. They were like, oh, and so they rushed the case and then they screwed up. And the Supreme Court was like, sorry, you screwed up.
The Supreme Court?
I'm sorry, the Arkansas Supreme Court.
Thank you for that distinction. I was like, it went to them?
Sorry.
Okay.
So the judge did say, however, I don't want to like make it sound like the Arkansas Supreme Court was like, she's probably innocent. No, the judge said, okay, this is a really long quote. Sorry. If she upon retrial is again sentenced to death, the trial court should again reject her argument that the death sentence is disproportionate to this case. If it is true that the one who pulled the trigger is serving only, I'm sorry, it is true that the one who pulled the trigger is serving only a life sentence, but he was a young college student, while Hendrickson was a mature adult and, under the proof, the procuring cause of the murder. There is evidence that Hendrickson entered into the contract to have her husband killed for financial gain of over $600,000. The death sentence is not disproportionate under the circumstances of the case. So basically the judge said, she guilty, you messed up, retry her. And she's still able to get the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So she did get the retrial. However, she was found guilty, but she got a life sentence without possibility of parole.
Okay.
Which to me is more proportionate. Personally, I find that more proportionate to the crime just because it was like, I want to kill my husband, not I want to kill a random civilian and then more random civilians I find on the street and I will murder wherever I go.
That makes sense. I mean, personally, I am against the death penalty. So I'm like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
No death penalty, just as a principle.
So some number of years after Norma fled to Germany, she determined that it was safe to return to the States. She did return to Iowa and got remarried and presumably changed her name. So no one quite knows where she is. And Mark ended up dying from brain cancer in 2010 when he was 48. Howard passed from natural causes in prison in 2011 at the age of 49. I don't know what natural causes there are for a 49-year-old. Maybe he had some ailment, but prison records aren't exactly going to be like, oh, he had this ailment and this ailment, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
As for Pat, I did a inmate search and I found her. And she is a tiny old lady and she does smirk at the camera. And she is still alive. It's kind of funny. They list her sentence length as 999 years, 999 months, and 99 days. So I guess that's how they put it in the system.
Okay.
She hasn't faced any disciplinary actions, so I guess she's been good. And she is considered a minimum level risk.
Okay.
Just real quick, I pulled most of this information from a scholarly commons article that I linked to in my sources. Please go read it if you want a little bit more information, because the person who wrote it really dives into like a lot of the more intimate details. I kind of skimmed over it just because we're already at an hour and 20 minutes before editing. Mm-hmm. But I do want to warn you that if you go to this article, please skip page 22 because I wasn't expecting it. They have two very graphic photos of Oren's body.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just scrolling along and I saw the ransacked house and then boom, I was like, oh, okay then. So please be careful if you go to look at it. But yeah, that is the case of Oren Hendrickson.
Well, Zoe, thank you very, very much for this very well-researched story.
Well, thank you.
It was a lot to process.
Yeah.
But you told it very, very well, so thank you.
Yeah, despite the fact that I kept getting Mark and Howard and Oren and Pat and
there were Norma. A lot of names, and they were all talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. They really were.
So everyone, if you appreciated today's episode, please rate, subscribe, review, tell a friendo, subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/hauntedhospitality. For just $3 a month, you get a new episode from us.
Yes, and it comes out on the 13th because we're spooky. If you want to see my sources for today's episode, you can head over to hauntedhospitality.wordpress.com. And if you have your own spooky story, no matter where it is in the world, true crime or paranatural, supernatural, you can reach out to us at hauntedhospitalitypodcast@gmail.com or slide into our DMs.
Yes, we are on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Haunted Hospitality. We are also on Twitter at Haunted Hosts. We hope to see you there.
Stay spooky.